Boy, I hate it when that happens. Nice radioing. Dude. Uh-oh. There's something wrong with the chain. The light's on. The fader's up. Oh, yeah. Plug the mic into its cable. That way, you know, it can serve its function. Yeah. Great start to the show today, Scott. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway. So it's a radio show. If I'm too dumb to plug in my microphone before the show, I might be too dumb to get anything else right. That's the chance you're taking here. Fair warning. But I was competent enough to arrange for Philip Weiss and for Bruce Schneier to be on the show today. Experts on Israel and computer security issues, they. Phil Weiss, friend of the show. Bruce Schneier, I don't know, friend of the show, but he's all right. He's been on the show a few times over the years. I like him. I admit I can't understand all the things that he says. This computer stuff's hard, man. If you're not one of them, you're kind of on the outside of that stuff. Am I right? Anyway, the man talks sense when it comes to what's what. Seems like to me. And wrote a thing I enjoyed reading for The Atlantic. That's how to get interviewed on my show, by the way. If you want to get interviewed on my show, write something that I would want to interview you about. That's how that works. So he wrote a thing that I wanted to interview him about. So, yeah, good. I invited him, and he said to you, why, yes. Isn't that great? Okay, good. Bruce Schneier. And also Phil Weiss. Lots to talk about with him as well. Okay, let me talk about this. My website, scotthorton.org. Go there if you want. If you go there, you'll see my interview archive. More than 3,000 interviews. No, really. More than 3,000 interviews at scotthorton.org/interviews. You can find the whole show archives there. You can also find my blog, Stress. And you can join up the chat room like I'm trying to do right now. I'm going to be Scott33 today. If I can get the captcha right. Sometimes it's hard to read the captcha. Although, hey, you should know the good news about this chat room. I think this is a big deal. Maybe not in 2014, but seemed like a big deal to me a year or so ago when I realized I no longer needed XChat or ChatZilla or Pigeon or anything else. You can use all those things if you want. I'm not saying that. But all you need to do, all you need to use to participate in the chat room is any old browser. Even if you use Opera or Internet Exploder, or whatever the hell. It's all right there at scotthorton.org/chat, embedded right in the page there. Which is how I always wished that it was, but it wasn't until recently. And hey, I already got a pretty good handful of people in there. Hey, everybody. They like saying interesting things to each other, and mostly sitting and stewing and brooding in silence, too. I don't know. Maybe you could join in the chat room and strike up a conversation. Especially if you have old El Camino you're restoring. They love talking about that. Who was it with the El Camino? I don't even remember anymore. Well, you know, the fans of the show, they come and they go. I've been at this a long, long time. Anyway, scotthorton.org/chat. If you want to hang out in the chat room. Also, I will direct you to the right side of the page there. You can see a big link to Amazon.com. And in fact, let's see if you hover over it. Is it a big complicated link? Where's my status bar? Show me the dang. Well, anyway, it should just take you to scotthorton.org/Amazon should just take you to Amazon. only where the show gets a kickback from anything you buy there. And your price doesn't go up one red cent. It all comes out of Amazon's end of the deal through their affiliate program there. So it's good for them anyway, because they're still making their profit, some profit, and I'm, helping direct people their way, they figure. So they pay me out of their end of the deal, not your end of the deal. And so that's all you got to do. And in fact, I'm going to go ahead and plagiarize this from Mark Edge, who I heard saying this on Free Talk Live. Bookmark it. But you could bookmark it too, whatever the hell that is. If you know what it is, then you could do that. You could bookmark scotthorton.org/Amazon and just keep it up there in your bookmarks toolbar. And then whenever you go to Amazon, you just click that. Then you don't even have to waste time stopping by my site first. You could also just go to my site, scotthorton.org, and it's right there on the right side of the page. And that'd be a nice little way to help make sure that the show can keep running and keep paying those international phone bills. And power to the microphone, assuming that I've bothered plugging it in on my end. Well, you know, I have to unplug it to move it out of my way. And then you would think that whenever I move it back into my way for the talking into, that I would plug it back in right then all in one motion and make sure that that was taken care of. You would think that, but apparently no, not every time. That's why to go to scotthorton.org/Amazon whenever you go shopping at Amazon, and they sell everything, not just books. So I can afford longer mic cables. Does that sound like a plausible explanation? I do need some new equipment in here. Some of this stuff's kind of burning out. It's old. Anyway, I think that's the coolest thing ever. The Amazon affiliate thing. You know, if I could get all y'all who shop on Amazon, which is virtually everybody, to just stop by scotthorton.org first when you do, even if I'm just getting, you know, you're just getting one book and I'm just getting 48 cents. Man, that's killer. That's excellent. All them 48 cents add up to a little bit, and every little bit counts. That's scotthorton.org/Amazon. So, yeah, please do stop by there. It already seems to be, you know, working. It seems to be picking up a little bit, too. I don't know. Word's getting out or what? There you go. All right. And so now, this can't wait until Phil Weiss time. I just can't wait. I just have to get right to. Very little time here. From Arutz Shiva, IsraelNationalNews.com. Officials, that is, Israeli officials. Kerry, that is, U.S. Secretary of State and former Senator John Kerry. Officials, Kerry, way out of his league in talks. And boy, ain't that the case. And this is about how John Kerry is a punk. He is a loser. He's to be disrespected and ignored and pay him no mind because he's unsophisticated. His plan is unusable. He doesn't even know how to read the maps right. John Kerry is pathetic. That's the official position of the Israeli government. So much for his framework toward the negotiation on whether to have some talks towards an interim agreement toward the expansion of more settlements and the conquering of the West Bank by the right-wing Israeli nationalist expansionist state. John Kerry thinks he's going to come in here and work out some kind of agreement of any kind. We'll have no agreements. We'll dance through your little charade for a little while if you want. Might as well be 1993 right now over there.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. You like coffee? Me too. Hey, if you're a true connoisseur, you need to try an amazing new roaster out of L.A., Tonks Coffee. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best coffee beans in the world. They get the beans directly from the growers, roast them, and then ship them to you within 24 hours. They're as fresh as can be. Tonks is a subscription-only service, and they're offering a free sample to listeners to this show. Give it a try. If you like it, you can sign up. Then every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible coffee beans roasted to perfection. If you're hitting the cafe or drive-thru most mornings, this is a better and more economical way to get great coffee. Go to tonks.org/liberty. That's tonx.org/liberty. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, we're going to get back to Iraq-Syria news. Syracuse or something. It's the new nation state of Sunni Islamo-Fascistan. George Bush is the founding father of. They're George Washington, really. In a roundabout way. Not very roundabout, just a little. But as long as it's now finally way after the fact becoming clear to people about just what that war was about and which side America took on it and how it stayed that way and why and who won and what it led to over there. You know what I mean. The Shiite Arabs in league with Iran getting the south and getting the capital city and empowering Iran. And then, of course, the radicalization of the whole region, the corruption of the currency of the whole region as they all race to inflate along with Bush and Greenspan, which was necessitated by the war. They had to make it seem free, so they printed the money. And so that helped destabilize every country in the region, plus the fact that every country in the region is run by a sock puppet dictator run by the United States, the people who were doing most of the killing in Iraq, the country right next door. That helped delegitimize all the different governments around the region more than anything. Not that they were legitimate, I'm just saying destabilize everything over there. And, of course, the biggest, most direct blowback from the Iraq War is the creation of Zarqawi's group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, what now calls itself, has since, I guess, 06 or 07, called itself the Islamic State of Iraq. And look at them running around now. They've virtually, at least for now, maybe permanently, have erased the border between Iraq and Syria. Have begun the foundations, have at least declared the reality. Whether it's any real such thing, I guess, remains to be seen for the long term. But they have now declared the reality of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The Islamo-Fascist Caliphate that Bush pretended we were fighting over there. It was the one that he created. And, see, I didn't want to get too far into this, because my point is, now that everybody can tell, so the Iranians were empowered. The Iranians and Al-Qaeda are the winners of the war. This is what I've been trying to tell you the whole time, by the way. But anyway, now that people are finally getting that, I think it's worth looking back on one more part of this thing that often goes ignored. All the arguments of all the warmongers during all the worst years of it. During the whole thing. You know, after the first few weeks, when it was determined, not that this was a good enough casus belli or anything, but still, When you could tell after the first few weeks that, man, it wasn't true when they said they knew for a fact where there were warehouses full of VX and sarin gas and a nuclear weapons program and all of this stuff, that that was all lies. Instead of everyone demanding the war end, then everybody just split 50-50. You know, it was 70-30 for the war, but it split back to 50-50. But the 50% who were for the war and for the president and for the right during that whole time, they never gave an inch. Maybe some of y'all listening right now wouldn't give an inch. Oh, we can't cut and run. Remember all the slogans? You can't cut and run. Oh, you can't change a horse in midstream. Oh, you can't. But meanwhile, what did all that mean other than let the Republicans keep giving them the blank check to keep doing what they're doing? People who lied you into war in the first place. And then listen to those people. I mean, really, the Americans who supported them were no more guilty of sloganeering than, and I mean believing in the slogans even, than the people in power. You know, they still to this day, they're, I think half of them anyway, are just, you know, I mean, are the people who implemented the policy up there in the defense and the State Departments and whatever during the Iraq War. They're blind to what they did and who they did it for and what it all means, you know? They don't have nearly the clarity that the average reader of antiwar.com has had over the years about what's going on over there. And so, you know, you don't have to argue that, yeah, it sure would be great if Saddam Hussein was here, although, geez, I think he'd be preferable to a bunch of suicide bomber bin Ladenite lunatics running around all over the place, spreading like a virus from the battleground we created for them there. But it doesn't have to be that way. Saddam had to go sometime. All of us die. And he had enough enemies. And maybe when he died, his sons would have just taken power, or maybe things would have changed. Maybe if even you took into account the invasion, or just took for granted the invasion of 2003 and the regime change against Saddam Hussein, if they had left immediately, you know, like they weren't interested in staying or anything, but it just said, okay, we got rid of Saddam, turns out can't find the weapons, so I guess we can go ahead and go now. If they'd done that, then at least there would have been, it would have been much more likely. Certainly, I mean, there were plenty of people, including myself, arguing this at the time. But it's certainly got to be a proven fact in hindsight, pretty much, that if the Americans had left in 03, that all the different factions in Iraq would have had a lot more incentive to deal with each other, to sit down and come to agreements, rather than just fight it out. And now maybe there would have been a civil war anyway, and maybe the Shiite Arab majority and their leadership would have been just hell-bent no matter what on taking Baghdad. But remember, they used the Americans to do most of that fighting for them the whole time. And if the Badr Brigade had had to take on, you know, the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad themselves with, what, just Iranian money behind them? Nah. They would have come to a deal. They would have had to have come to a deal. And anyway, so there was no good outcome in the Iraq War. And, you know, take it from me, my job was answering letters from, well, anybody, but including a lot of military guys at antiwar.com back in 2004 and 5 and 6 and for that matter. And everybody would write in talking about, man, we're doing so much good over here, and you have no idea. And this was officers, too. You have no idea what good we're doing over here. And I would say, yeah, good for who? Tell me all about what you know about Abdulaziz al-Hakim and the Badr Brigade and the time they spent in Iran. And they would answer back, huh? Yeah, yeah, democracy this and purple fingers that. And the thing of it is it's all such horrible lies, but a lot of the policy is based off the lies. A lot of the policy is based off the slogans that are used to justify the policies in the first place. It's a big part of why none of them make any sense. You know, Obama came out the other day, or I don't know when it was now, I just read the quote the other day, of Obama saying, hey, listen, it's not like we're trying to take sides in any Sunni-Shia civil wars over here or anything. Really? What he means is he can't decide which side he's taking. Is America on the side of the Saudis or the Iranians? Pick a side and fight for it, or pick none. Back off. In fact, and this goes back to the, you know, I think the Americans and the Israelis are obviously way in the lead on this, but everybody loves to point to the Saudi king or the Saudi ambassador's statement that we ought to cut the head off the snake. Yeah, America, attack Iran. Well, Gareth Porter pointed out that at that point, it looked like the Americans were going to do it anyway. So the Saudis were just saying, yeah, we're with you. Go ahead and do it, kind of a thing. But you think the Saudis are going to talk all tough guy about having a war with Iran if they had to fight it themselves? You think there would be a Sunni-Shia civil war, proxy war being fought between the Saudis and the Iranians right now if it wasn't on your dime? And on both sides again? And look, this isn't, you know, as brutal and murderous as the Reaganites were. When they were backing both sides of the Iran-Iraq war, they at least were doing it on purpose. They knew what they were doing, trying to bleed them both to death and weaken them both, and without letting either side come to a clear-cut victory, at least after the first. I think they expected Saddam to win quickly, but then when that didn't happen, they went ahead and they kind of switched back and forth. Robert Perry has talked about that, how they didn't back them both equally all the time at the same time. They sort of switched back and forth to kind of keep it equal. But in this case, the Americans have been fighting to strengthen the Iranians and then to turn around and strengthen the Saudis in opposition to the Iranians. So it's not like they're weakening these two sides, wearing them out against each other. They just keep creating new Al-Qaeda training grounds wherever they go. And new Hezbollah training grounds, too, for those who put Israel first out there and are more concerned with Hezbollah than with Al-Qaeda. Well, where do you think Hezbollah is getting their battle-hardened fighters from right now? What battles are they being hardened in? Other than the American-Israeli-Saudi war against the Baathists in Syria on behalf of Israel. You know? For crying out loud. Oh, no. We can't cut and run. You got to stay the course. You got to... If we leave now without a satisfactory conclusion that no one ever bothered to define because they couldn't, because it would give away how guilty they all were, they had to aim with, explain what they were aiming towards. But if we quit before this undefinable time horizon, as Condoleezza Rice liked to call it, well, then we're betraying all the guys that died over there. Like the betrayal wasn't in getting them killed. The betrayal would be if you don't get more killed because you already got some killed. Come on. It's sad, but it's true. It's as simple as George Carlin says, too. We think in language. And so if they can manipulate the words that you think in, they can manipulate your conclusion. So if they can really, you know, get you to buy into the jargon of the sunk cost fallacy and the valor of the fallen on a fool's errand, then they can have, what, at that point, 6-7 more years of war. And for what?
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me, you heard it here.
Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking and war,
Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're at scotthorton.org. And on the Liberty Express, libertyexpressradio.com. And our first guest on the show today is Bruce Schneier. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic and chief technology officer of CO3 Systems, a computer security firm. His latest book is Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust That Society Needs to Thrive. That's interesting. Welcome back to the show, Bruce. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you back on the show, and very happy to point people toward this article in The Atlantic, How the NSA Threatens National Security. Before we get too far into that, I wanted to ask you real quick, if I could, now that we're a little bit more than half a year out from the beginning of all the Snowden revelations, for someone like yourself who is such an expert in computer security issues before anyone ever heard of Edward Snowden, what have you learned from his revelations, if anything, or what's the most important part of what you've come to understand since the Snowden-Greenwald leaks?
So what we've learned really is the extensiveness of the NSA's operations, both breadth and depth. I mean, in some respects, nothing's really a surprise. If you looked up a cartoon villain of the NSA in the years before, these are the sorts of things you'd expect them to do. But we really didn't realize how extensive their operations were, how much of the internet they eavesdrop on, how many people they eavesdrop on, how much data they collect. And more importantly, we didn't realize how much they're actually subverting the fabric of the internet, how much they are deliberately weakening products and protocols, making it more insecure for everybody so they can eavesdrop. We sort of knew the budget in general terms, but to see details, it's really a big deal, and I think it's the reality of it, the cold reality of the details, that's most surprising, even though it's really not that surprising, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I certainly knew that they're keeping track of, I've heard from a very much a layperson point of view still, but I've been keeping track of NSA-type stories since the 1990s and always just assume that, yeah, they can turn your microphone on if they want to. Yeah, they're keeping track of your triangulation data and whatever so that they can compare it later. But basically, a lot of what, I mean, and I've read my Bamford and everything, but a lot of what we're talking about, I guess, is sort of just, you know, what people in the know kind of know. They're like, oh, yeah, they're way outside the law. They kind of are watching everything. But now we can really see it in their PowerPoint slides. Yep, this is the way we do it, all right. Here it is all for you in color, not even in black and white.
And the details make a difference. And really the debate we're having is this the sort of thing we should be doing? I mean, if the Snowden revelations said the NSA was spying on North Korea and the Taliban, nobody would care. Right? That's what we want them to do. So they were spying on the G20 and Belgium and the oil company in Brazil. You know, all of these groups that we think, you know, why are they doing this? Right? That they're collecting emails from everybody, cell phone location data from everybody. These sort of bulk collection and collection on nominally our allies, that we wonder, is this worth it? And then at the enormous cost of really breaking the trust of the internet, you know, suddenly you look at the agency and say, you know, maybe you've gone a little too far.
Oh, and I'm sorry, Bruce, tell me about what you mean by breaking the trust of the internet.
So fundamentally, we all believe the internet is secure. It's secure for banking. It's secure for commerce. It's secure if you're a Chinese dissident. It's secure if you're doing things that you want to be private. And a lot of people rely on the internet for their lives. It's one thing for the NSA to spy, right? Take the internet as it is and spy on it, but they've gone a step further. They've actually deliberately weakened the products and services everybody uses. So, and when they do that, they're weakening it for everybody. In a lot of ways, the debate has been mischaracterized. A lot of the debate in the United States is, should the NSA be allowed to spy or not? And that, I think, is fundamentally wrong. The real debate is, should we have an internet that is vulnerable to every attacker, or an internet that is secure for all users? You can't get to say NSA spies and no one else can. Either everyone can spy, NSA, China, Russia, other countries, cyber criminals, or nobody can spy.
Right. Because, and like you're saying, they're deliberately breaking all the locks. Even there, as we've read in some of these stories, they're bribing the companies to put out broken encryption keys in the first place.
And this is an important point, that once, and they do that, they bribe, they coerce, they threaten, they engage in legal action to get companies to deliberately weaken their products. Once they do that, anybody can exploit the weakness. Like, there's no magic NSA-only weakness that doesn't exist. You know, they have a secret, but other groups can find out that secret. And as we see, a lot of the techniques that the NSA is using are techniques China uses, are techniques criminal uses. They're not really magical. They're just bigger budget. Mm-hmm. So we have a choice. We can make the internet safe for everybody and secure for everybody, or we can make the internet vulnerable for everybody. And a vulnerable internet is much more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your piece, again, it's how the NSA threatens national security at the Atlantic. You talk also about how we've learned that it's not just the NSA, and I think, I'm not exactly sure the way you wrote it, whether you're referring to what all the NSA is passing on to state and local and other federal agencies, or the ways in which our local police are now just mimicking the NSA and tapping our cell phone locations themselves, or all of the above?
So we're not sure exactly how this works, but it is clear that the FBI is using a lot of the NSA tactics domestically. We don't know if they're developing them independently. We don't know if the NSA is passing along technology or if the NSA is passing along data. We do know the NSA has passed along data to both the IRS and the Drug Enforcement Agency and had them lie about where they got it. This is directly against the law. But a lot of these techniques we see the CIA using, we see the FBI using. So there is certainly some kind of technology sharing and potentially some kind of data sharing. Right? We know the FBI will often do the NSA's dirty work in the U.S. A lot of company denials have been saying, you know, we don't work with the NSA. Well, they might not. They might work with the FBI on behalf of the NSA, possibly even secretly, that the company doesn't know that the FBI is working on the NSA's behalf. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors in the government surveillance, and it's very hard to pick out exactly who does what to whom. Right? Same thing abroad. The government of Belgium has been complaining about NSA surveillance. The government of Germany has. Both of those are NSA partners surveilling on other people. Right? The government of France complains about NSA surveillance. The government of France has its own surveillance. UK and the United States are strong partners, each doing what the other's law prohibits. U.S. and Canada also. Remember recently, the Canadian equivalent to the NSA was found in violation of the law, because what it would do is it would say to the NSA, we're not allowed to do this sort of spying. Can you do it for us?
Mm. Well, another thing that you talk about in the article is how this... And this is sort of the subtle thing that doesn't get mentioned that much, in a way, where everybody gets bogged down in all the technical details of the different stories and that kind of stuff, is that this is all about a fundamental change in the relationship between the individual and the state that nobody ever got a chance to vote on and say that they were willing to have, you know?
And I think that's
much harder
deal
to take it back once, you know, you found out it's gone this far.
Yeah, and that's very important. And while we can talk about individual programs, I mean, right now there's a bill in Congress to prohibit bulk collection of cell phone call data. But that's just one particular program. And we're learning from the Snowden documents that the NSA has many different programs to get the same data using many different legal authorities. And going after this piecemeal is just not going to work. And yeah, we need a fundamental discussion in our society of where the lines are. What is private and what isn't? Right? The conceit is that this stuff keeps us safe. But that has not been demonstrated at all. I mean, all the evidence shows it is a complete waste of money. But we really don't have these sorts of discussions, and these things have sort of come upon us when we weren't paying attention. And some of it's our own doing. Right? You know, Google knows more about what you think than anybody else, because as soon as you think of something, you go on Google and you ask it.
Yep.
Right? Your cell phone company knows exactly where you've been every minute of the past some number of years, because you've always got that phone in your pocket, and that phone is a tracking device. So we are all leaving these digital footprints as we go through our lives. Right? Our friends are on Facebook, our business is on Gmail, or our cell phone, commerce is all online now using credit cards. So what used to be anonymous is now being recorded. So there's a lot of corporations who have this data, and the government's just getting itself a copy.
Right. All right, now, I guess very quickly, last question here before the break kicks in, Bruce. What do you think is the best avenue for pushing back?
Well, there are two parallel avenues. There's a technical avenue and there's a legal avenue. Technically, there's a lot we can do to make surveillance harder, to re-secure the Internet. And it's real important that the techies start doing that, and they are. The second is legal, that we have to rein in the NSA, other countries. I mean, this is not an easy problem. It's like any kind of arms negotiation or nuclear weapons treaty. We have to be able to come up with international norms and ways to enforce them against bad actors. But we need to recognize, first and foremost, that a secure Internet is in everybody's best interest.
Right.
And a vulnerable Internet is in everybody's not best interest.
All right, everybody, that is computer security expert Bruce Schneier. He's a correspondent now writing at The Atlantic. The latest is how the NSA threatens national security. Thanks very much. Oh, bye. We'll be right back after this, y'all.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much for listening. Hey, coming up on the 20th, 11 days from now, you won't forget, I'm sure. I'm going to be interviewed by Tom Woods on The Tom Woods Show. How do you like that for a turnabout, being fair play and all that? Of course, I can't ever seem to get Tom on my show anymore these days. He's doing so much production of libertarian propaganda for the world. I guess I can't hold it against him. But part of what he's doing, of course, is his new podcast, which actually runs right before this show on the Liberty Express Network, which is nice. Thank you very much. Hat tip to Tom Woods' coattails. Good old friend of mine, and I'll be on his show on, I think it's the 20th, at least I'll be recorded on the 20th, I don't know when you'll hear it, and then the topic will be the wars, so that's pretty cool. I've never been interviewed by Tom before. I mean, I guess he's asked me questions when we talked on the phone before, but that's not the same thing, I don't guess. Anyway, all right. Hey, listen, I want to talk to you about cashintocoins.com, but instead, I'm going to play Mark Edge from Free Talk Live talking about it real quick.
Bitcoin average has Bitcoin price currently at about $900 a Bitcoin.
Hey.
Bank of America has predicted it at $1,300.
What does that mean? They've predicted it. That's that they think it's going to cap out at $1,300?
No, what they tend to do is just raise their caps as these organizations. You know, somebody wants to. It's easy to be right by predicting Bitcoin at $1,300.
Sure.
We were right. Now we predicted it at $1,800.
Right.
Right. Like, so that's an easy thing to be right at. Now,
It's interesting that Bank of America is acknowledging Bitcoin.
Oh yeah, they've acknowledged it. That's true. Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, current head of the Federal Reserve, he's acknowledged it too. Said it has promise.
Yeah.
Alan Greenspan, not as big of a fan.
Okay.
But it's kind of interesting. I don't recommend Bitcoin as a vehicle for gaining wealth. But the fact of the matter is that Bitcoin's going to have to go up in value if it is going to be a real currency, is, you know, stabilize and become sort of a real currency, a currency that's very usable. Currently, you have to kind of go through some, aerobics to make it work. So if you use Bitcoin to buy something, you want to replace the Bitcoins you have by buying more Bitcoins. And so it functions more like coupons than it does like a currency. But a lot of people are getting Bitcoins and seeing, their wealth increase as a result. You can get Bitcoins by going to cashinthecoins.com. They are the easiest, safest, fastest alternative to getting Bitcoins. They're inexpensive. The fees are quite low. Customer service is their top priority and completely legal. A lot of people are worried about Bitcoins and the legality. Cashinthecoins.com has all the paperwork that they need to have for that. All you need in your town is a Wells Fargo, a Bank of America, or a credit union with shared branching. This covers the vast majority of the people in the United States, and I'm not sure exactly what they do as far as folks outside of the United States. Cashinthecoins.com, however, has all the answers. It's easy to use. I've used it. I did it without any coaching at all, and there was no mistake. There was no point where I'm like, oh, I messed up. It was that easy. Cashinthecoins.com.
Well, there you go about that. In my Twitter feed, it says that Overstock.com, which announced, last week that they're going to start accepting Bitcoins, is now accepting Bitcoins. I saw a couple of posts about that. One guy said he's gone and bought something from Overstock.com with some Bitcoins. That's pretty cool. And you know what? I wanted to point out this very interesting article by Eli Durado. It's in the umlaut.com. No, really. You know, like Motorhead has the cool little dots above their O? Yeah, they have a whole website called that. The umlaut. Don't worry about that. All you have to search is Bitcoin isn't money. It's the internet of money. Huh? Well, that's why you read the article. Bitcoin is not really a currency. It's a new part of the internet. It's a new way to transfer money on the internet. And he talks about, 10 or 15 new innovations in ways that bitcoins can be used. The dollars can't be used. And the way that you can build contracts into the payment. How you can build dispute mechanisms into the payment. How you can set it to pay by fractions of bitcoins per moment. In the teeny tiniest amounts. And how, so he starts out, what he does is he starts out saying that, you know, the famous Paul Krugman quote that the internet is no big deal. I mean, most people don't have anything to say to each other anyway, right? So this isn't going to have any more effect on the economy than the fax machine. And that's because what he didn't realize was that the internet was a whole new way of communicating rather than just a new tool to communicate with. And that as long as there's open entry into ways to use that HTML, and people could just come up with new and more and better ways to do it, the innovation was, well, as we've all seen, unbelievable, unimaginable. And of course, it's changed everything, and it's increased productivity by a gazillion percent. All across the economy. And so what he's saying is that when Krugman says bah to the Bitcoin, that he's making the same category mistake. That's the argument in the article anyway. I think it's very interesting. Bitcoin isn't money. It's the internet of money. And It sure does make it sound like it's got a lot of promise there. On the other hand, I will mention this. I saw this article, "The Existential Threat to Bitcoin, Its Boosters Said Was Impossible, Is Now at Hand." And that is, you've got some Bitcoin miners who have all pooled together to work together to mine Bitcoins together to share the profits together. But that this one group or these couple groups working together, Gash or Ghash, I guess it is, Ghash.io, came close to controlling the majority of the world's Bitcoin mining capacity. And apparently, for some reason, isn't it cool living in the future where everything is all crazy? For some reason, if that happened, then they could completely just counterfeit Bitcoins all day. Double and triple and quadruple spend the same Bitcoins and whatever. It would corrupt the entire thing. I don't know why. I don't understand it, but that's what they say. And they showed a picture of the Reddit page, the Bitcoin Reddit page, where people were saying, "Hey, log out of the group mining project. We're doing too good. We're going to break it." Very interesting. It's by Christopher Mims. "The Existential Threat to Bitcoin, Its Boosters Said Was Impossible, Is Now at Hand." He said they didn't anticipate that people would come together in these, virtual group mining operations, which, pretty big hole in your theory there if you didn't anticipate that, guys. So we'll see what happens. I don't know. I don't understand everything about it, but it sure seems like they've got a lot going for them. That they really thought through at least a lot of the problems that could come up with a digital currency like this. It's interesting to watch, that's for sure. And hell, I guess while we're at it, I'll hit refresh. I own 0.06 bitcoins right now, so my interest is purely curiosity. A bitcoin is now trading at $917 at Mt. Gox, as you're listening, if you're interested. All right, so when we come back on the show, Phil Weiss is going to be here. We're going to talk about Israel-Palestine issues and perhaps a little bit of Israel-America issues, America-Iran issues. These are all the very same thing. And then we got news out of Egypt, military spending, and the Iraq and Syria wars. I'm going to get back to that. Suicide attacks in Russia right before the Olympic Games start. What is it, always the Olympics or what? And then if I have a minute, I'm going to stick up for Dennis Rodman again. In fact, I guess I got my minute right now. I got 15 seconds. Listen, this Rodman character, he's the guy in the wedding dress and whatever, right? Yeah, so what? He's a kook. So what? He said the wrong thing about a missionary. That doesn't have anything to do with it. If TV compels you, you just refuse to look at the actual point. Opening and warming relations with communist North Korea so that it'll stop being so commie all the time. Or do you prefer it this way? Sorry if the basketball guy hurt your feelings about your missionary. It has nothing to do with it. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I was pleased to see that Blue Cross finally responded that, okay, fine, they will honor my request and cancel my policy. It took them a day and a half to even get back to me to acknowledge that I had said cancel the policy. But anyway, thank goodness that's a done deal. Boy, what a rip-off Nazi fascist business that is. Blue Cross Insurance, I'll never do business with them again. I mean, I hope to avoid ever having to have a job where it's not up to me. But man, what a horrible way to run a business. Don't you just hate Blue Cross? You know, they make more money if you die. They prefer it if you just die. Yeah, it's right there in footnote something something. Go look it up. I bet you'll find it. In fact, I bet you someone in the chat room is posting it right now. Yep, that's the way it works. If you're an insurance company, what you want is for your customers to be dead. You know, as long as more keep getting born, it's alright. But keeping you alive, that's what costs a lot of money for them, you know? They want to avoid that. They want to collect all your premiums and then kill you. Well, I mean, they're the adjuncts of the Congress. What do you think they're here to do? Heal ya? That's why it's fascism. The government controls the private property and the means of production because the owners of the private property and the means of production want it that way. Because they're the ones who control the state, or at least think they do. That's why we call them brown shirts and fight them. And hate them, even when they call themselves Democrats, even when they call themselves health insurance companies. They're Nazis, that's what they are. They're the health Gestapo. No honor in that. No, sir. Blue Cross, we make more money when you die. That's their official slogan. I just came up with it, but... Well, I'm an executive vice president there. Didn't I mention that? So I get to make that their slogan if I want to. Blue Cross, give us money, then we'll kill you. We'll do everything we can to see that you die soon. Oh, that extremely important thing that you need? Sorry, we don't cover that. Oh, yeah. The Democrats wrote a law says everybody's got to get insurance. But then if anything happens to you, the deductible is $6,000 per person in your family for the very least amount of coverage in the first place. That sounds right, right? Because that's what it means to be poor in America is to have, you know, $12,000, $18,000. $24,000 sitting around in savings somewhere, right? Right? Yeah. Nazi Democrats. And their Blue Cross scam. Scammers, I tell you. All right. Good. Canceled. Canceled. Hope you all get sick and denied. Blue Cross people. Well, at least, you know, the officer corps. The enlisted people there, they're all right. But the officers there at Blue Cross. May you all get coverage capped. All right. Is there an alternative? Will I be able to have health insurance to protect, especially my wife particularly? I don't know. But it ain't going to be from Blue Cross. No. Thanks a lot, Democrats. Hey, the Egyptians arrested the Al Jazeera news guys. Now, Nancy Youssef from McClatchy went and checked on them, and they're still alive and doing okay, I guess. Oh, what happened to my story about that? Well, I lost my story about that. But that's a big deal. You know, I worry about Adam Morrow. I mean, he's not a member of the Muslim Brotherhood or pro them really or anything, but he kind of is pro them. He seems sympathetic more with their point of view, right? I would say to good, honest, and opinionated journalists in Egypt to watch your back, man. The American military dictatorship there, they're pretty ruthless torture murderers. They've been proven to be so. All right, and now, hey, check this one out. This is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Secretive congressional talks aim to settle Pentagon spending. The Senate broke a lot of its own rules to cram through... Oh, did I say this is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com? I did, right? The Senate broke a lot of its own rules to cram through the massive military spending bill a few weeks ago, authorizing $607 billion in spending, $520 billion in general spending, and another $87 billion for the Afghan occupation. Officials are used to the idea of pushing through whatever they want for appropriations bills, but secretive talks have been ongoing with both House and Senate defense appropriators trying to sort out a problem. They don't have that $520.5 billion. It's more like $490 billion, according to preliminary reports, and that's fueling a lot of talk about where they're going to make cuts, and a lot of determination to keep the details from going public before the backroom deal is finished. Pensions are likely safe, at least for the top military brass, while the initial budget deal cut the pensions of rank-and-file soldiers. The much juicier retirement benefits for generals and admirals remains in place and are believed to be untouchable, and in fact... Dang it, man, I didn't save it because I just went, yeah, yeah, it's another day in America. But there was a story just the other day, I think lower down on the page on antiwar.com, about how the officers have better and better pensions than ever before. Not only do they not have to sacrifice a thing, they're living like kings. They are kings. And anyway, so... So much for the sequester and belt tightening, and you know they're gonna go ahead and spend that 520, and they'll come up with the money. That's what I think. That's the option I think he left out of there. That they're gonna write the checks, and then somebody's gonna cash them. They don't even have accounting at the Pentagon anyway. Who cares? They can write checks to whoever they want for anything they want. Yeah, that one wasn't that interesting. This one was, though. Useless $350 million NASA space project mandated by Congress. Let's think if you had $350 million, how much $350 million is. Useless $350 million NASA space project mandated by Congress. So here's what it is. They're not even making the rockets anymore. But they're keeping the test station for the rocket that no longer exists engine. And they're just going to keep on testing it. And no, I'm not kidding. It's just like those planes they're actually having manufactured in Italy that are then being shipped straight to America, straight into mothballs. They're not even going to use them at all, and yet they're still cranking them out. This is what happens when you put big business and big industry on welfare like this. It's just make work projects. It's just digging a hole and filling it back up again. Only, of course, you know, with killing people. Most of the time when it comes to these defense projects. But that's all this is it's just welfare for the rich. Welfare for engineers and those who employ them. And literally, it's a test stand. A $350 million test stand for a rocket engine, for a rocket that has been discontinued. Oh, Scott, you must be reading that from worldsocialists.org. Nope, stripes.com. Do they still have worldsocialists.org? I was kind of going off the cuff there. I think they do. Hey, they do some good journalism sometimes, actually, the World Socialist website. I give them credit. I mean, they're commies and everything. But their criticism of, their details, their journalism about, you know, what's happening in American foreign policy is actually a lot of times pretty useful. But this is just from Stripes, from Stars and Stripes, that is. Useless $350 million NASA space project mandated by Congress. That's what they mean when they say military-industrial complex.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
Oh, man, I keep alternating back and forth between just allergies and a little bit of a cold. Die, germs, die. Kill, kill, kill. Dead germs make the grass grow. Come on, white blood cells, rally. See, I'm not so anti-war. I sound like I am a lot of the time, but when it comes to germs in my body that are making me sick, I'm all for my white blood cells committing complete genocidal holocausts. Hey, it's my property. They're trespassing, the germs. I've got the right to defend myself. Simple as that. They're aggressing against me. God dang, haven't y'all all read The Ethics of Liberty? Nah, I don't think he talks about germs in there. Yeah, anyway. All right. So I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. The website is scotthorton.org. Scotthorton.org. Keep all the interview archives there and this, that, and the other thing. You can support the show at /donate. Or at /Amazon. Just go Amazon shopping and I'll get a little kickback. I'd like to mention that. Seems good. All right, now, so there's this guy named Pat Lang, and he's a former CIA and I guess DIA officer. I think from time to time you can find Phil Giraldi in his comment section. He keeps the blog Six Semper Tyrannis, a committee of correspondence. That's thus... always unto tyrants. That's what you yell right before you assassinate someone, apparently. Maliki is fighting locals in Ramadi and Fallujah. And here's what, at the bottom he says, this person is well known to me, and he has access to this information. So take that for what it's worth. But it's one of these... ex-CIA Giraldi type guys who criticize the government a lot. And so Lang's source writes him and says, per discussions with contacts in Baghdad that have links in Anbar, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, that's the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham or the Levant. I wish they would get their acronyms straight and just pick one. But anyway, ISIS and Al-Qaeda are not re-embedded into Anbar yet. The government is mainly fighting local groups that are opposed to both Baghdad and to the Sunni tribesmen on Maliki's payroll. Yeah, that's the first I've heard of Maliki even really paying Sunni tribesmen. I thought he left them all high and dry. I guess I didn't know. But so it's... the non-sock puppet tribes taking on the sock puppet tribes among the Sunnis in Anbar, he's saying, okay? At the same time, some local groups have been targeting Al-Qaeda elements plus fighters flowing back in from Syria. Maliki is using this effort as a means to bolster his electoral chances to get the Shia base aligned against the Sunni threat and further fragment the Sunni communities in support of a broader strategy to ensure Shia dominance and enable Baghdad to turn its full attention north. And he doesn't mean to fight the Kurds. I don't know what he's talking about. Maybe he does.
For Al-Qaeda, it may yet seem enough space open wherein the tribes will invite them back into Baghdad to battle for Baghdad in full, but the tribes will want it on their own terms, as such a multidimensional battle will continue to evolve in Anbar. Shia versus Sunni communities, tribals, Shia versus Sunni jihadists, Sunni faction versus Sunni faction, and Sunni faction versus Sunni jihadists. And this is who's at war in Anbar. So yeah, they're not taking Baghdad back anytime soon, but they're not going to stop fighting anytime soon either. And you know what? Maliki's army isn't going to be able to take Baghdad. You know, I don't know the degree to which the assault is on. They keep saying they're laying siege and they're delaying the attack. But yeah, 13,000 families have fled Fallujah amid the standoff on the assumption that the Iraqi army is about to launch a full-scale invasion of the city. Fallujah tribes ready to fight Iraqi army. Military delays attack as tribal leaders issue warnings. You know what? I'm going to check the latest here at news.antiwar.com. The latest from Iraq there. I guess that was it. And then, you know, here's the good news about Iraq. Is that John Kerry said, hey, it's their fight. We'll send them weapons, but we're not going back into Fallujah. And, you know, I wrote an article back in 2009, right when Obama was taking power, called Finding Ways to Stay in Iraq. That maybe they would draw down in order to surge into Afghanistan, but then they would leave still a foothold in Iraq and have the excuse to go ahead and escalate back again. Now, I have believed, and I think I still believe, that the statute of limitations on my bad prediction there, my negative prediction for the future, ran out at the end of 2011. They really did kick the last of the American army out of there. You just got the State Department, CIA goons at the embassy, and the Marines guarding them, and that's about it. And now maybe that's a lot of CIA. I don't know how many you count and how many is a lot, but the U.S. Army really did leave. There's no Air Force bases, no nothing. They're done. And so I have thought up until now that, well, good, I was wrong. That the Iraq war would just re-escalate. Although, then again, all the same factors I was considering are the very ones in play, such as Petraeus said the surge was supposed to achieve these benchmarks, such as the Shiite, American and Iranian-backed Shiite Arab majority government in Baghdad, that they would work with reincorporating as much of the old Iraqi army and the old Iraqi government as they could and compromise with the Shia, with the Sunni, who are now on the outs, and with their tribal leaders and the ex-Ba'athist regimists and whoever, and with their foot soldiers that the Americans had called the Awakening Councils and the Sons of Iraq and the concerned local citizens, that they would all get jobs and be incorporated into the Iraqi army. It would be a nationalist Arab Iraqi army and not a sectarian one. And yet it was so obvious all along that that wasn't happening and it wasn't going to happen. And Maliki's position was all those Sunni Arabs can all go and screw themselves and all their leaders are under arrest. And what are you going to do about it? The Americans already gave them Baghdad. What do they need to... They don't care about Anbar. What's he going to do? Lose his army fighting for Anbar? I don't know. Maybe he will. Maybe a little bit of a fight is just good politics for the upcoming parliamentary elections. But I don't think... Well, I don't know. If they tried to put... I don't think Obama wants to do it. But if they did want to try to put the army back in there to help Maliki fight in the Anbar province, what would the American people do? What would the American people do if they said, listen, George Bush broke it, and we have to help Maliki keep Al-Qaeda down there. Otherwise, we're betraying our ally, our democratic friend, and blah, 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 right?
All we're going to do is we're going to send some CIA drones with Hellfire missiles, and that's going to do the job, huh? There was no Al-Qaeda, and that was worth invading 10 years ago. Now the place is crawling with them because of that invasion. They could clearly just use that. They just ignore, just act like a Washington Post writer and completely ignore the fact of the history and just pretend history began yesterday like they always do and just say, hey, there's Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We got to invade now. What would the American people do about it? Another war in Iraq? Or would they, like in Syria, take the Sunni suicide bomber jihadist types side against the Shiite government? Not that any of these options makes much sense. But, yeah. You know, it's funny, too. Whenever I think about the dawn of the Iraq War 10 years ago, I always picture this one clip of Bush in probably December, January, December 2002 or January 2003. And Bush, it's snowing in Washington, D.C., and he's got his overcoat on and his cowboy hat, and he's walking between one part of the White House and the other or something like that. And a reporter asks him something. And, you know, the sound might not have even been on when I saw this. It was just the scene of Bush in his overcoat and his cowboy hat pretending to be such a tough guy and pronouncing all of this tough guy stuff at the camera about, you know, his tough guy war that he's going to do against Saddam Hussein and just how sure of himself he was. You know, hey, we know what disarmament looks like. What you do is you bring all your nuclear weapons program that we accuse you of having and your chemical weapons stocks that we accuse you of having, and you show up at a mutually agreed upon parking lot with all this stuff. As long as he's not doing that, then we know he's guilty and he's in material breach of the UN Security Council and just gonna have to regime change him. You know, like he's strutting, making his shoulder, trying to like stretch his shoulders out and make them look wider than they really are and all that kind of crap. Look at me, I'm George Bush in my cowboy hat in the snow talking about how I don't need to know what I'm doing just because I'm a mean SOB. And that's all I need. I don't even need data, much less, you know, wisdom. I don't need to know nothing. Sunni, Shia, I thought they were all Muslims. Whatever happened to that? Aren't they Muslims? Quote George W. Bush, the guy who did this. I mean, it was kind of him. Mostly him.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning in. If I sound like I'm slouching in my chair, it's because I am slouching. I got a new chair, and it's kind of slouch-inducing. I'm comfortable, though, so I hope it sounds okay, although slouchy. All right. Well, ScottHorton.org is the website. You can find all the interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now at ScottHorton.org. And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. Hey, you should do that. All right. Good. Our next guest on the show today is the great Philip Weiss, keeper of the blog Mondo Weiss, and a longtime accomplished journalist of many other different descriptions as well. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
Good, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm very happy to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Cool.
I like you slouching. You're no slouch. Oh, sorry, that was my line. You're no slouch. You scripted me. You told me ahead of time about the joke, and I was supposed to say, you're no slouch. And I failed. I'm sorry.
Did I give you that line? I should have.
Didn't you email me that and said you were this whole setup and I was supposed to say that?
Whatever. You'll still get paid. Don't worry about
it. Okay,
thanks.
All right.
Okay, good. All right. Hey, so listen. Yes. This whole peace talks thing where John Kerry, the Secretary of State, is going to go over there and work out a Palestinian state, two-state solution type of a situation there. What's the deal with that? How's it going? Working well?
Fait
accompli?
No, it's not going very well, and, you know, your listeners should understand that it's all going to have to end in April. I imagine they'll try to extend the deadline, but it's supposed to end in April, and think of it this way. Condi Rice, in the second Bush term, went nuts, you know, trying to get things together. You know, she set up, I guess it wasn't just the second, she was already working on the first, but she set up Annapolis,
right.
You know, following the roadmap to peace from the first term. And what came of that? Nothing. At least there was some kind of roadmap to peace. You know, you had the two guys standing there with some type of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And in this situation, John Kerry's been over there 10 times. Next week will be his 11th time. The guy is obviously working very hard. He's a, you know, earnest, you know, sincere guy in a lot of ways. And what's he got to show for it? They're not even standing next to each other. And all he's trying to get, right now he's just trying to get a kind of a roadmap to peace statement. That type of statement out of him, he can't get there.
Right, so a framework. What does that mean, a framework?
I think a framework means, you know, without getting too semantic, which they do as soon as they try, any of these guys who tries to explain it, they're soon in a swamp of words. So I'm going to just avoid that by saying in 2000 there were the Clinton parameters, in 2003 or 4 there was the roadmap to peace, and then subsequently there was Annapolis. Each of these things, and before that there was Oslo in 93, 94, the Declaration of Principles. In each of these cases, you have, hey, we're gonna work toward getting a state, and these are the basic ways that we're gonna try to do it. So that has been set up several times over, and this time they can't even get to that language. So, in the other cases, they set up the language, sort of, these are our goals. This is what we want to do, and in 5 years we want to have a Palestinian state. That's what they said in 94, the Declaration of Principles. And, you know, that produced nothing. And the Clinton parameters produced nothing. The Annapolis, the roadmap to peace, produced nothing. This time they can't even get the sort of blueprint, the playbook established. And they can't even get these guys to stand next to each other and say, yeah, we agree on this is the framework. And the framework, by the way, the quote-unquote framework, is very similar to what the Clinton parameters were. They were, hey, we're going to set up two states basically along the 67 lines, but with various exchanges of land. We're going to divide Jerusalem, that kind of thing. In fact, this framework, already the Israelis are making demands they've never made before, and the Palestinians are saying this is not. It's just the thing's falling apart before our eyes.
What are the new demands the Israelis are making?
Well, one demand that the Israelis are making is that the Palestinians must recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And Netanyahu, the right winger at the head of the Israeli government, has said this on a number of occasions. And the Palestinians have said, no way, we're not, part of this process is we'll recognize Israel as a state, but we're not going to recognize it as a Jewish state. That would be like in America, expecting that blacks would say that this is a white state, you know, a white country. 20% of Israel's population is not Jewish. So there are a lot of reasons that Palestinians would not want to do this. But basically, it's an obstacle that the Israeli government has set up so that it doesn't have to come to an understanding with the Palestinians. They don't want a Palestinian state. They're dead set against it, this government.
So, yeah, they're just moving the goalposts to make it harder and harder to kick through there is all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they've pretty much made up their mind that they want the West Bank. The program of Zionism since the 1920s or 30s has been, we want the land, we don't want the people who are on the land. And we're going to do what we can to get as much land with as few Palestinians on it. That program really kicked in 47 and 48 after the UN resolution creating a Jewish state, when they helped expel a lot of, they expelled a lot of Palestinians from lands that became Israel. So, and this is their program in the West Bank. They want to grab the most fertile land that they can in the West Bank with as much water on it as possible and herd the Palestinians into towns, make life uncomfortable for them, get them out of there. Mm. It's not a pretty picture.
Well, and so at this point, it's just what they want is, you can call it whatever you want, we'll make up 10 new descriptions for some vague aspirations, forever doing the opposite of the actual facts on the ground, as they call it, as they're being created there. And the Israeli position, are they going to just force march all these people into the Jordan River, or are they going to put them on some future train all to the Gaza Strip, or they're just going to keep it like it is and just keep expanding apartment complexes until they cover the whole West Bank and the Palestinians are all just homeless living in the alleys? Or what are they? There's got to be some kind of plan here. What the hell is the plan?
There's no vision.
Because how many Palestinian people live on the West Bank?
I'd say somewhere, including East Jerusalem, occupied East Jerusalem, excuse me, we're talking about somewhere north of 3.5 million people. So, that's a lot of people. And I think there is simply no vision. There's a hope that ultimately, the Palestinians will be, would accept some type of citizenship under Jordanian sovereignty. That's what the right-wingers want. They don't want a Palestinian. They say, we can't trust the Palestinians to have a state just on our eastern border because they'll be firing rockets. So we've got the only way that they can have rights is under someone else's sovereignty and not theirs. So it's just a hopeless situation. There's no vision whatsoever on the part of Israel's leaders with respect to this conflict that has dominated the kind of is Israel's existence from the start in 1948. Mm-hmm. But Scott, I just want to ask you here: how much of an understanding of is there out there in the country, as you perceive it, about this peace process and what it's producing or not producing?
Well, the best I can tell, not very much. Although, you know, I have a better answer now to another question you've asked me before, and this may be the same answer to the question you just asked me, too, about, you know, what it is that best I can tell other people believe about this. And it finally did occur to me, this was the term, the jargon, as all this, as you said, so wrapped up in semantics. The jargon I couldn't quite recall that explained the way this subject was introduced to me anyway was land for peace, land for peace. In other words, the Palestinians are holding the Israelis hostage, and unless the Israelis give up some land to them, the Palestinians are going to keep suicide bombing their children in the pizza parlor. And then they never explain where these Palestinians come from, where they are, what side of which border they're on or whatever. They sound like they're coming across some frontier, and how horrible is it that the whole world and the commie UN and everybody expect the Israelis to give in to these hostage takers' demands, that they have to give up their land in order to get a cessation from this terrorist onslaught? And that's at least, you know, the right-wing talk radio version of it.
Oh, okay.
And I would suspect that with all of its unproven and many times, in many cases, unspoken false premises and assumptions in that, I think that's pretty much what most Americans believe. That's
really
at least the way the jargon with which the subject was introduced to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, and what it meant to me, you know, vaguely anyway. You know, back when Israel-Palestine represented a subject that I was sort of interested in but hadn't gotten to yet. You know what I mean? When I was younger.
Yeah. But what about my belief that there are people out there who have a more historical understanding, who are beginning to people in small towns, small cities, regional cities, big cities, all over the heart of the country, who would say the Palestinians have gotten the shaft. I'm tired of hearing this Israeli story about their terrorists and this and that.
Yeah.
These people have gotten the shaft. You don't think there's much of a reception about that?
You know, I hope you're right, and I plead ignorance. I mean, I certainly don't want to be the naysayer on that. It seems to me just completely outrageous. And you know what? They call it the crying and shooting. To me, there is nothing more obnoxious on the planet Earth than the Israeli government crying victim all day. It's disgusting, and it's laughable. And if everyone doesn't see it that way, I don't know what the hell is wrong with them. I mean, other than they just don't know where to look at a source that isn't just parroting whatever, you know, MSNBC would have Alan Dershowitz tell them, you know?
If they're exposed
to the facts, I mean, what are you going to do? They've been occupying these people since 1967, never even mind the whole Nakba before that. But just look at these people living under a foreign martial law for 40 years.
Yeah, I guess I have to believe that some of this understanding is beginning to creep in because, I mean, for no other reason than people have heard this talk about a Palestinian state now for 20 years, and, American presidents have been saying they want a Palestinian state for certainly 14 or 15 years. I guess George Bush was the first one to say it, but...
Right. Yeah, it was a scandal when Hillary first brought it up during her senator election at the end of the Clinton years.
I remember that.
She actually said the word, and it was a scandal, but that was when they really started moving that way. Anyways, I don't really know as much about before that as you. Hold on. We've got to take this quick break, and we'll be back with the great Phil Weiss from Mondo Weiss. That's MondoWeiss.net. Great bunch of writers over there, not just him.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I got to make a correction. The Israelis crying boo-hoo as they shoot is tied for first place with most obnoxious with the American government crying and pretending they're the victims as they rampage around the world. Israel, I guess... I pick on Israel all the time so much just because it's like America's little mini-me with the exact same hegemonic designs and aggressive foreign policy and lies from dawn till dusk, just on a little bit smaller scale regional instead of global hegemony, but, you know, they're working on it. And anyway, it is. It's the very same thing as, George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton or Bush Jr. or Obama. Crying boo-hoo about what a dangerous world it is that they have to kill all these people to protect us from, you know?
I thought we were their mini-me.
Yeah,
I thought we took these lessons from them, but, you know, that's because I believe in the Israel lobby theory.
Yeah, well, no, America had to be an empire to recognize and guarantee Israel's existence in the first place, I think, you know, but it's a vicious circle, you know, it certainly... It goes around and comes around.
Yeah, but I don't think... The good news is that I do not think they're going to get their Iran war out of us.
Well, now, so let me ask you about that, because there's some coverage on your blog about, you know, the Senate. You're referring to Jim Loeb's work about how many Democrats and Republicans are lining up for sanctions in the Senate to try to sabotage the Iran deal. And yet, as loyal foot soldiers they are to AIPAC, you say that they're not talking about it back home to their people. They're not trying to brag about that at all. And because as much as the American people dislike Obama, what the one thing about him they support these days seems to be that he's trying to work out some sort of peace deal with Iran and end that Cold War enmity with Iran, which, you know, I'm proud of the American people for that. Finally, to kind of have a little bit of a let's knock this stuff off for a little while. Take a breather from all the wars for a minute, you know?
But so, Scott, you think that the American people are having some influence over their government in that respect?
A little bit anyway, yeah. I mean, I read just not too long ago, just kind of anecdotally, Chuck Hagel saying, look, the American people just don't want any more wars over there. That,
right.
And
but you didn't need to read
that
Chuck.
Hey, these are the constrictions that we public servants have to live within now.
Right, but don't you think, I mean, on that one, don't you think that Chuck Hagel is actually sincerely committed in his heart that he's expletive deleted if he's going to allow America to get into another war?
No, I wouldn't say that.
I have more faith.
I mean, I think that he knows better, but would he stop it? I mean, look at Robert Gates didn't do what it took to stop Obama from doing the Libya war, and we all knew at the time that he was against it. But he couldn't win a fight with Hillary Clinton over whether to start a war when he's the Secretary of War. It's because he didn't do his job in stopping it. He didn't do what it took to stop it. And so that's the kind of thing that I would expect out of Chuck Hagel if it comes down to it. In fact, he was maybe didn't do a great job, but he was right there next to John Kerry testifying to Congress about why we had to do Syria back September. So,
well, I mean, you mean Hagel was?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, back to the politics of it and the politics that I know about it.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, you know, Jim Loeb said that has reported, well, I mean, now everyone knows there are 47 senators who've signed on to this legislation that would basically say, let Israel decide whether there should be a war over there, and we have to support them if they want to go to war. So it's Loeb has called it the wag the dog legislation. Mm-hmm. And there are 47 senators who've signed on. AIPAC has supported it, but the critical thing to remember is that AIPAC used to be able to brag about getting 70 senator signatures overnight. Mm-hmm. This time they've gotten 47 over a couple of months, or over a month or so, and those 47, according to Loeb, are not bragging on it. They're keeping a low profile on it because they know how unpopular it is out there. And even more important, you have people like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's really a foot soldier of the Israel lobby. She led the ovations in the Congress when Netanyahu came to address the Congress a couple of years ago, 29 standing ovations. This congresswoman from Florida, who also chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is supporting Obama on this and saying, we don't want more sanctions on Iran. We don't want this legislation. We want to go ahead with a deal. So in that sense, the Israel lobby has been divided.
Yeah.
And that's good news.
Dianne Feinstein actually is good on the sanctions too, at least at this point, correct?
Yeah, she's been good. I agree with you, and there have been a number. And, you know, I mean, I always am saying, look at these Democrats who are supposed to be liberal and anti-war, several of whom, I mean, the generation's passing, but several of whom got in because of opposing the Vietnam War, and they've supported the Iraq War, and, well, there are like 13 or 14 Democratic senators behind this, including all these blue state powers like Cory Booker and Chuck Schumer. But I don't think that, generally speaking, I think the kind of liberal Democratic group is not signing up for this thing. So that's a good sign.
Yeah, it is. Those dynamics are changing. And in fact, you talk about... It's the Beinart piece. I read that too in Haaretz. Peter Beinart, who was a liberal hawk during the Iraq War days, and then has basically been a sort of mild critic, I would call it, compared to you anyway, of of America's Israel Policy recently, ran the Open Zion blog at the Daily Beast there for a while, and he was saying that the Israel lobby's control in D.C. worked too well, and that they have basically frozen themselves out of power after a fashion. What exactly is that about? Can you explain that?
Well, I think what he's saying, if I remember the piece correctly, the one that I've embraced a lot of his stuff, and this one, I mean, he said that the American Jewish leadership, by supporting Israel and Netanyahu and the settlement program blindly, has alienated itself from American Jewish life, where American Jews are more liberal. So he's perceiving some of these sort of divisions and breakages that we see in Debbie Wasserman Schultz versus Chuck Schumer. I think that I forget exactly which piece you were referring to, but generally speaking, I think Beinart is, these guys are going to be saying, in a few years, these guys are going to be saying, who lost Israel? And they're going to have to say the Israel lobby and the right-wing Israeli government's overreached. They wanted too much. The Israeli government wanted too much land. They wanted too much Zionism. They wanted too much sort of Jewish superiority in that state. And they overreached. They thought they could get it with the support of the Israel lobby, and they're not going to get it. And now, as you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, they have no vision for the future. The central issue that they have to deal with in their society going forward, sort of like the South had to deal with Jim Crow, or the South had to deal with, the whole country had to deal with slavery, that central issue, which is essentially a racial question, racial-ethnic question, they have not resolved. Mm-hmm. They have no way to resolve. And so they are just sort of cruising along toward a situation in which the slaves are going to be freed and are going to get to vote. And as far as I'm concerned, it couldn't come a minute too soon.
Well, now, you know, I know that there are some who think that that's the worst possible solution, because what it really means is another major war against the Palestinians, that the, you know, Netanyahu will put on his mirrored sunglasses and his camouflage, and they'll just not accept that. That if they back themselves into the corner where they make a two-state solution impossible and a single-state solution the only thing, the last thing they're going to do is really relent and have one man, one vote. They'll give up democracy before they give up the Jewish state, right? They'll kill
them. Yeah, I mean, that may be. I guess the important thing from my standpoint, I mean, first of all, obviously I care about the Palestinian people and also the Jewish and Israeli people, as I care about the people in the Central African Republic or in Sudan. But, you know, you, like me, you know, I take your lead here. There's a limit to how much we can prevent bloodshed in other places where people have not figured out their problems. And the critical question in this, I say this as first an American, then as an American Jew, is I don't want my country having anything to do with further ethnic cleansing on the part of that government, or their inability to resolve a fundamental constitutional question by, as you say it, you know, some type of genocide or ethnic cleansing or transfer. I don't want any part of that. And as an American Jew, I say, you are not representing me as a Jew when you do this. You are merely representing, you know, fascist tendencies in a Jewish supremacist state.
Right.
So,
and of course, American aid and subsidy for all this is the single most relevant factor. If you look at, for example, these talks, if Kerry was able, they say he has a 10-hour conversation with Netanyahu. I don't know what they're talking about. As long as Kerry can't say to Netanyahu, you don't get any more money and you don't get any more free Lockheed products if you don't get the hell out of the West Bank. As long as he's not saying that, the occupation is going to continue. Netanyahu knows that he can continue taking America for granted. We're easily moved. It's absurd.
Yeah,
right?
But
and Kerry's not telling him anything
right
to make him believe anything opposite than that, is he?
Well, Kerry may be a doofus here, but the one thing I'd leave you with, Scott, is apropos of other things you've said here, if you go back to Obama's speech last March when he went to Jerusalem, he said, here's the deal. This is how you can save your state. I believe in the Jewish state. This is how you can save it. You want to do it, you got to do it. Cut the deal. They haven't cut the deal. They're not going to cut the deal. And I think no drama Obama, the cool Obama, he will walk away from this. And that is the great thing in all this, is that the possibility exists now that there's a roadway for America to say, to brush it, wash its hands of this, and said, hey, we tried. Obama, I don't think he cares the way Kerry does. I think Obama would say, you know what, I tried. We tried. I went there, I stuck my neck out, I told you what to do, you didn't do it, screw you.
Yep. You know, Andrew Coburn wrote that and said on the show that Obama doesn't like Kerry at all, and he'll be damned if this is going to happen and work, and Kerry's going to get the credit, not him, so he'd rather have it not happen at all.
That's funny.
That would surprise me if that's a big part of this, really, you know? These guys, these politicians, they're all a bunch of lawyers. All right.
Thank you,
Scott. Thanks, Phil, for your time. I appreciate it. All right, everybody, that's the great Phil Weiss, MondoWeiss.net, for all his great writings there. I wish I had more time to cover more, but please go and read his great blog there. Oh, we didn't get to talk about Graham and McCain. All right, see y'all tomorrow.